here with my dear friend, Carol A. Furman. Some people say Furman. I think that's what you said you like better. And I'm so excited because Carol's one of my favorite people first. And if I buy art, I have to like the person if I get to meet the person. In this case, I did. Hopefully, Carol likes me too. Maybe not as much. Anyway, I'm happy to share with the listeners the power of art now. And that's what we're talking about is an art cast versus a podcast. And what the world needs now is what we really want to focus on today. And we definitely need people like Carol in the world. I'm lucky to know her. I feel fortunate and to be surrounded by her beautiful artwork. For me, art can save a mood, a day, an experience. It's a distraction, it's an inspiration, it's a sharing opportunity, and through artists, whether they're vocals or they're fine artists or photographers, artists can create a lot of love in our life. And love for artwork and sometimes the artist itself comes together, and in this case, it has with Carol Furman. Anyway, Carol, thank you for being here. Thank you for inviting me to be here. This is actually a space that Carol has decided to create for podcasts. So if you need a podcast done ever, or a music studio, or a studio to shoot your fashion collection, I recommend 170 Moore Street, Brooklyn. Is that where we are? Yes, 170 Moore Street in Brooklyn, which is also another building besides this where Carol nearby has her art studio. So Carol, it's now all about you. Please tell me, what is the most important, what's your philosophy? I just shared mine. What's important to you?
Well, number one, you have to have a dream. And if you have a dream, you have to be passionate about it, because just a dream is one thing. You have to always remember to follow your dream. And no matter what people say, if they put you down or they say that's no good or your artwork is no good or whatever it is you're doing isn't good, believe in yourself and persevere.
That's beautiful. And so how long have you been persevering? When did your career begin, more or less?
Well, I like to say it began when I did my first painting on my parents' new linoleum floor when I was 3 or 4 years old.
And what was the next painting you did that someone would maybe buy because your parents didn't have to buy that one?
Well, I was selling my artwork when I was in public school, and my friends were buying it, and a neighbor bought a piece. I did a painting of their children, and I didn't know what to charge because I was like 16 years old. So I said, pay me whatever you want, or pay me $300, and they paid me $500.
And this is in high school. No wonder why your artwork has increased so much in value. It started high, and it's gotten only higher. So your first artwork that you sold at a gallery, what year was that? When were you represented by a gallery?
Well, I was selling a lot of work in college, and it wasn't sculptures because I had...
Through a gallery?
No.
So when were you selling in a gallery?
A gallery? Oh, that took years and years because the women hadn't broken the glass ceiling, and it was a good old boys club in the art world. Women were not considered a good risk by an art dealer. They would. The dealers thought that a woman, if they put money in them, then the woman would maybe stop doing her work and have children, and so.
But on a positive note, the one who gave you your break, can you remember who that might have been?
Yeah, that was a woman.
A woman, okay.
Gallerist. Her name is Ann Jaffe, and she believed in me, and I was doing one of each sculpture. I did about 6 different fragments. I started with that. And she said that she would represent me, but I had to make more than one. I said, I'd be lucky if one would sell. She said, no, just make 3 of each. And I said, 3? Who's going to buy them? She says, I will. So she bought 3 of each of my first 3 sculptures.
And these were of a torso, a body, a face? What were
they? Well, one was a ballet piece. Another was the swimmer that I'm world famous for. And another was another swimmer.
Wonderful. So what is the most important part we're going to move forward in what you're doing right now in your work, in this moment? Now, and it's so interesting because it sounds like you take a lot from the past in terms of what you're doing presently, but can you share us the importance right now of now?
Well, what leads up to this moment and what makes it now is everything I've ever done. And when I look at what I'm doing, a lot of it is I've started in the 80s. And they're all themes that run through my life, like my feelings. They're not just beautiful, perfect swimmers. They're each one tells a story of Serena, like this is the survival of Serena.
Right.
It started as inner tube, and I was inspired by the women floating on tubes coming in from Cuba to Key West. And so I did the survival of Serena, and I started it in 1981. And through the years, I've changed it. I made her different color tubes, and I made it different sizes.
Yeah, you mentioned to me about Survival of Serena was 1981, and you also mentioned Midpoint, which was 2017.
Yeah, that was a much later piece.
And you had mentioned to me that it's a combination of those two that has something to do with this piece you're working on right now?
Well, you know, there's always turning points. I didn't name it Turning Point. I named it Midpoint because the girl was quite young who posed for me. And I remember she asked me if I could make her breasts bigger. And I thought that was interesting.
Well, I don't know. They look nice-sized breasts to me.
Well, she wanted to be a woman. You see, you have to look beyond what someone says.
Right.
And I was thinking, so she's at a midpoint. She's no longer a teen. She's more a young adult.
Right.
And it was a turning point.
But again, the now. What are you working on right now? In the moment.
Well, COVID has made a lot of changes in what we do, and I'm working on a piece called Eyes Open. And interestingly enough, the eyes are closed. And that's because I see more when my eyes are closed, when I lie in bed or when I just meditate, and then I can see a finished sculpture in my mind. So I did this sculpture called Eyes Open, and the eyes are closed. So.
Now, you mentioned to me a work called Serenity.
That's very, very new. In fact, I just began. And, you know, it's a combination, in a way, of both Survival of Serena, where she's leaning on her arm, mm-hmm. and Midpoint, where she's at a midpoint, but in a different way in this piece. She's more serene, like serenity, and it has a lot of meaning.
She looks very peaceful and calm. Do you feel that
serenity
way?
Serenity is peaceful and calm. So do I feel that way? I feel so blessed and fortunate that I have worked through COVID, that I have been able to do my art, and people have appreciated it more, maybe because they want to beautify their homes, because they're home more. But
how about how the art makes them feel, possibly, too?
It makes me feel good.
Right.
So hopefully they feel good, because a lot of people don't want things in their house that make them feel bad. And my work has always been about beauty and love and
absolutely
peace.
You mentioned that you were making a tabletop. I mean, this looks quite much larger than a tabletop, but you said you're making tabletop
pieces. That is tabletop? Yeah,
okay.
It's maybe so big.
Okay. And why that size? Does it have something to do with the time we're in terms of people spending more time at home and having it in your home to enjoy?
I started doing tabletop pieces about 5 years ago, and I was interested in the different proportions of pieces originally. Sometimes when it's life size and it's got every little freckle and every little thing, it could be scary. Mm-hmm. Not to me, of course, because I live with them.
Right.
But something interesting happens when you make them monumental, for instance.
Absolutely.
If they
come alive.
Well, if the pyramids...
People think they are alive a lot of the time.
If the pyramids were small, who would go to Egypt?
That's true. They're awesome. They're awesome.
Yeah. So
your sculptures are awesome.
But you know, the monumental ones cost a lot of money, and you can't fit them in your home. So that brought me to the idea that I would make smaller pieces that people can put in their apartments, or people who don't have the kind of money to spend $500,000 or $1 million on a big piece. For much, much, much less money, they could buy something that's a tabletop size.
So a tabletop. Could you give us an idea, the addition size and what they could cost someone if they wanted to purchase one? Thank you.
Well, they are usually 12 to 14 inches I've started to make them a little bigger, like 16 or 18 inches, and the least expensive one is under $15,000, and they range all the way up to almost $50,000. But the editions are very small.
And the $50,000 is because it's a smaller edition?
It's because they're all small.
They're all small
editions.
They're
all small. There's no more than nine.
Nine.
And sometimes less.
And so why is one $15,000 and one $50,000?
Well, one is very, I called it mini-quan.
A mini-quan,
and
okay.
The other, and these are much more complicated. They take longer.
I know she's one of my favorites. That's one of the ones that you do in a tabletop, right?
Right. That was the second one that I did. The first one was the mini-Serena, and the second was mini-quan. And then I didn't like the name mini because it reminded me of Minnie Mouse, so I changed it to tabletop.
Tabletop. Oh, so that's why they're called tabletop instead of mini.
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought
But you have several sizes in the tabletop.
No, most of the tabletop sizes are now much bigger. So the less expensive ones are the mini because they're very little, and they were edition of 99, which the first two were 99. These are very limited editions.
I understand now. Okay, very good. So now you're not doing tabletop as in mini anymore.
No minis, but tabletop.
But tabletops, and that size is about?
It's about 16, 18 inches.
Okay, very good. Can you explain a little bit of the creative process? You make a mold, a maquette, describe the materials. I know you have little droplets on their faces and you have hair on their eyelashes and eyebrows. Can you just go through your creative process with us? I know you don't want to give the recipe away.
Well, you can't give a recipe away because the creative process starts in my mind.
Of course.
So, you know, if I have a strong belief or a feeling about a subject, I want to talk about survival, I want to talk about balance or serenity, I come up with the feelings, the thoughts, and then I will look for someone to pose for me that I think that they have that feeling about them. They look serene or they look, you know, and then they're like an actor. They have to act out my thoughts. And I used to put rubber all over them. And I don't do that anymore. In a lot of the YouTube videos.
Why rubber?
Well, I would put silicone rubber on them and do a life casting. But I don't do that now. I do a 3D scan. And it's pretty easy. They only have to hold still for 5 minutes. And I get a photographer to scan them all the way around. And then I make a prototype.
And
from
prototype.
That scan.
What materials is that made out of?
Well, it depends on if it's monumental, then it would be foam. And if it's tabletop, it could be a form of plastic.
So when you say the word monumental, just to the audience, how large are your monumental pieces, for example? I know some are extraordinary.
From 12 feet to 36 feet.
Thank you. Okay.
And they're owned by cities. Sunnyvale, California has one.
The corporation, is it which company?
NetApp, but they gifted
it. NetApp.
Yeah.
Gifted it.
And another one is on the Hudson River called the Golden Mean. And it was, they won a grant to buy it, but also the museum helped them.
And which museum was that, do you recall?
Yeah.
That helped them?
In Peekskill, New York.
The local museum in Peekskill.
Yeah.
So you were saying those are all bronze?
Yes.
That's what they're made
bronze,
of? Okay.
Yeah.
And what are the other materials that some of your sculptures are made of?
Some are epoxy, some are bronze.
Okay.
And that's about the two materials I work with. And that's another reason of the price. So if I'm doing a tabletop edition of nine of, for instance, the midpoint, it costs one thing. You know, in epoxy, and then it could cost like $48,000 or something, just under $50,000 if it's a bronze.
Okay, so it can be 3-4 times more in bronze.
Well,
you're saying
not three, usually double.
Not usually double.
Not
okay.
even double.
Not
but
even
definitely
double.
More.
So, and do you like your sculptures in bronze the most? If you were going to own one, would you say buy it in bronze?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
You know, if you can only afford one. And you wanted to get it in epoxy, then you could carry it from one house to another.
Right, it's much more heavy. Light. Well,
move
light,
it, move
more
it
lightweight.
Around in your apartment, you know, and you might enjoy that.
Are the unique works that you make, are there any unique works that one of a kind no one else has? And can you
yes.
tell me about that why?
If it's more than, you know, 25 feet, huge monumentals, I'm only going to make one.
Okay. And could you explain, I know you have editions. At one point you were doing prints. Can you tell us a little bit about why you went into that market? Was it for a different collector or buyer? And are you still making prints, or are those just ones that are already been owned by other people in the secondary market they're being sold, or are you still making prints?
I was in a gallery recently, not recently, like 7 or 8 years ago in New York, and it was a print gallery. It was Jim Kempner Fine Art, and he has a beautiful garden. So what attracted me was the garden. But he was selling all these prints for huge amounts of money, and I was thinking, oh my God, so much easier to do a print than to do a sculpture that takes me 1 to 5 years to do. I could make a print, and then they could make an edition of 30 or 50, and I would have a cash flow from each one. But
smart.
It doesn't really work that way, because you make the print, and you lay out all the money, and then the gallery takes half. So if a print costs $6,000, and the gallery takes half, and it costs me a few thousand, there is not that much profit. So,
but you're sharing the art with more people because it makes it affordable for someone to own your artwork.
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of people love the prints, but more people want a sculpture. So I'm known as a sculptor. So I've not been making prints, although I do enjoy it. Just because if someone goes into a gallery and they're going to put money aside, they really want a piece.
One of the words you haven't used and you usually use because you're famous for that word is hyperrealism. Isn't that sort of, you're the queen of hyperrealism in terms of sculptures or not? Is that
yes.
fair to say? And can you explain what that is?
Well, I was the mother, the doyen of hyperrealism. I don't know about the queen, but...
Now you're the queen, you were the doyen.
I, along with Dwayne Hansen and John DeAndrea, started the movement in the late 70s. And hyperrealism is where, you know, it's so real that you think there's a real person. So it started that way. But I was always doing a fragment. So obviously, if it was just like a bit of a shoulder or two hands touching each other, it couldn't be a real person. And it was interesting to me because in just a tiny fragment of a person, the viewer completes the story, and the viewer participates in creating the art because it means one thing to one viewer and something else to someone else. And Dwayne Hansen is known for everyday people, and John DeAndrea was known for nudes. And the three of us showed in a very important show in Japan, and it was hyperrealism. But I've gotten a little bit away from hyperrealism because obviously a monumental piece cannot be a real person or a tabletop size. I mean, that's a very, very small person. It's like 14 inches high. I've not seen a person that tall. So I think something that you said was interesting. You said the hyperreal monumental, and it brings me to remember a piece in Central Park a few years ago when Serena was invited. This is Serena. She's very famous, my Serena.
I was there, I think, with you when Serena was invited.
And
you had the crowds around her.
Yeah, a couple walked over, and they said to me, I thought that was a real person. And it's interesting how your mind plays tricks, because your mind would say it's a real person, but obviously something 12 feet long. I never saw a person 12 feet long, so maybe 12 feet high, but I've never seen that either. So
yeah, even with high heels on.
I don't think it's hyperrealism anymore, although I'm called a hyperrealist. I think it's more...
You've evolved away from
my own thing, whatever that is.
Well, they seem very real. I love the little droplets. Is that resin, or what is the material?
Well, I'm the only one in the world that does the water.
Water
has a special meaning for me. My first swimmer was a girl coming, breaking through the water, which symbolized something in my life, my breakthrough. And I read a book by a Japanese writer who wrote about the power of water, and that it connects people, and that it won't crystallize in a place that's under war. I had Hiroshima, they can't crystallize water. And it stuck in my mind. And I'm always looking for a common thread when I do a piece, like an emotional thing. That's the difference between a male artist and a female artist. So I'm coming from a place of passion, a place, a sensual place, a woman, a place that I, as a woman, come from. And I think the water, having water on it, is something that connects people.
And that's something that you do with a brush? Or you won't tell
How
us.
I bet.
Or is it? Or do you just splatter it on? I'm sure
Definitely
you do it with a great
not.
Deal.
No.
Even your nails are done perfectly on your sculptures. I mean, every little detail, the eyes, the lipstick. I'm sure it must be a lot of detailed brushwork. And I assume, do you have other people that work with you on them?
Nobody does the water drops but me. I do have a big team of 14 people. I call them the A team. Everybody can do everything, but basically they do what they're best at. I have someone shipping, crating, people making epoxy pieces and various other things. But the water drops are my trade secret.
Okay, fair enough. Speaking of the pandemic you mentioned earlier on, I'm just going to circle back to that since that's the time we're in and we spend time together during the pandemic, you know, bonding and connecting. How has the art market been for you? Have you heard from the galleries? Are you selling artwork? Do you find you're connecting with artists? And are you doing this through your social media? Just tell us a little bit about how it's affecting your life the past 8-9 months.
Well, when it started, I was terrified. All the galleries were closed, and for about a month, I sheltered in place in my home, and I never went out till I realized one day that I could go to my studio because nobody was there. I could get in my car, drive to my studio, park indoors, and I would be, you know, would be alone. So I started doing that, and I felt much better. I didn't feel exhausted. I didn't feel depressed. I felt better. And like I said, it's led me to create pieces that have to do with maybe hope.
The serenity.
Yeah, maybe, you know, instead of survival, it's been a more positive experience. So.
And when you said you we're working on a piece called with the eyes being...
Eyes open.
Open versus closed.
Yeah,
so it
versus
seemed like
closed.
That's positive.
Yeah, and I think it's thought-provoking. You know, when you name a piece, people are saying, would say like, well, why are her eyes closed if it's called eyes open? So I'm always trying to get the viewer involved.
Participating in mm-hmm. the experience. I know at every art fair I go to, people crowd around your works, whether you're in Central Park when we were in Venice together, you know, in these parks, people would crowd around. I thought it was wonderful. Last year in Art Basel, I don't know if you remember, you had sort of a cast and people wrote on it. It was a plain white cast. And people just expressed themselves on this beautiful cast, which seems to me very important to you, that people express themselves.
I love
you.
People,
yeah,
and I like them to participate in one way or another in the creative process.
So, because so much we could talk about, but I think the most important thing is if you can just tell us what do you see in the future? Not so much your future, but the future of, you know, our country, our world. On a global level, besides what's important to you right now, can you give us the big picture, since you are a big picture thinker and you're a tabletop thinker too?
Well, I have been very nervous about our world, mostly as an American, about our political views, about our president, and about the art world under the president we've had, and it's created great anxiety, I will say. So hopefully we have a lot more to look forward to. I want, you know, with the new president-elect Biden, I want to enter the World Climate Agreement again, and I look forward to people being cognizant of the fact that we don't want to ruin our Earth, and I look forward to more peaceful times as my serenity and survival all say, because it's been turbulent. We have it feels almost like there could be a civil war at any moment, and I am hoping for the day that that things calm down, that people prejudice, racist, and all those things.
Is there a possibility for unity, or do you think it's just not going to happen? It's just not realistic.
Well, I thought about it. Eventually, I think it could happen, but certainly not in my lifetime. There's just too many people who are bigoted and racist and selfish. The selfish people, we'll always have those, and there'll always be some racists, and there'll always be some bigoted people. But I'd hope in the future, instead of it being 40% of all the people, we can get it down to maybe 10%.
Yes, well, the world...
It is getting better, because I remember when
a lot more people, women, are involved in the process, yeah, which I'm sure you and women, are very happy about.
We have a woman of color as our president, as our vice president-elect. That was unthinkable. We have a Catholic as with Biden, which was unthinkable years ago. And we have interracial marriages a lot. And that was, I remember when I was first married in the late 70s, they didn't have things. It was not even heard of. Actually, I was married in the 60s.
I wanted to ask you also, is right now the gallery world, are you finding that you're having to work closer together? Are you having to give up more? What's the name of your gallery that you currently have in New York City, or one of the galleries you
have? Well, I'm with Chase Contemporary in New York City. I'm with Art of the World in Houston. I'm with Madison Gallery out west. I'm with O'Neill Gallery in Canada. And I'm with Markowitz in Dallas and in Miami and Biba. And those are my...
And what about Bel Air Fine Art?
Bel Air is not in this country.
Yes, but
they represent me. He manages my career in Europe and in the Mideast. And he has 19 galleries in...
Great. And are they all working and open now and selling your work?
Well, Paris, I think, is shut down for a while. London is on hold. We're going to see what happens in some of the other countries with COVID. But I just signed a new contract for 3 years. Things have been better than expected for both of us. And we're looking forward to selling that $5 million piece.
I'm so pleased. Well, I wanted to say that you are the rainbow in someone's cloud, as Maya Angelou said, try to be the rainbow in someone's cloud, and you often are my rainbow. So thank you for always smiling and being the bright side, showing the bright side of things, even with the intensity and the difficulty. And as another wonderful woman that I think we both like very much, Beyonce, she says that power is not given to you; you have to take it. And I think you've always been that woman. Your whole career is about taking the bull by the horns and helping others to do the same. Thank you again, Carol Fuhrman, for sharing your wonderful stories. And thank you for One More Studios, as in number one, MOORE Studios in Brooklyn, New York, for hosting us today. Thank you.
And if you want to hear more about me, you can go to my website, carolfuhrman.com, or my Instagram page.